Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 8th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's escalating feud with Cruz and women. What happened? The Republican presidential race descended further into disarray this week as Donald Trump and Senator Ted Cruz became embroiled in a bitter clash over their wives. Trump's campaign manager was charged with battery, and all three remaining candidates walked back their pledges to back whoever wins the party's nomination. The spousal spat began last week when an anti-Trump super PAC sent out a nude picture from Melania Trump's modeling days to Utah voters, suggesting that she wouldn't make an appropriate first lady and urging voters to back Cruz. In response, Trump retweeted an unflattering image of Cruz's wife, Heidi, juxtaposed with a flattering shot of Melania. Cruz called Trump a sniveling coward and told the front runner to leave Heidi the hell alone. The National Enquirer then published a piece accusing Cruz of having affairs with five women. The Texas senator denounced the unsubstantiated allegations as complete and utter lies and accused Trump, a friend of the magazine's owner, of being behind the tabloid smear. Trump denied any involvement, but added that the Enquirer was right about O.J. Simpson, John Edwards, and many others. Trump caused a fresh uproar by saying that he wants to see a ban on abortion, and there has to be some form of punishment for women who get one illegally. He quickly backed off that statement. But the real estate mogul doubled down on his defense of his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, after he was charged with grabbing and bruising a female journalist at a campaign event in Florida. As his bad blood with Cruz escalated, Trump rescinded his pledge to support the Republican nominee, saying he was being treated unfairly by the Republican establishment. Cruz said he would not support someone who attacks my wife, and Ohio Governor John Kasich suggested he, too, might not back the nominee. What the editorial said. We thought the race for the president couldn't get any cruder than when Donald Trump told voters there was no problem with the size of his penis, said USA Today. But his mockery of Heidi Cruz's physical appearance marked an astonishing new low in American politics. As for the National Enquirer hit job, it's easy to see why Cruz thinks Trump was responsible. The only person the article quoted was Roger Stone, a former Trump staffer known for political dirty tricks. Cruz isn't an innocent victim, said the Los Angeles Times. Unwilling to alienate Trump's many supporters, the ambitious senator has looked the other way when the frontrunner insulted other candidates, journalists, even entire populations. It is only now that Cruz's own family is in the spotlight that he has recovered his sense of outrage. Trump's passionate defense of Lewandowski tells us a lot about his character, said the Washington Post. Had he simply acknowledged what happened and apologized, that would likely have ended the matter. Instead, he portrayed the reporter as a liar, and even when police released a video clearly showing Lewandowski grabbing the reporter's arm, Trump said, "Look at the tapes. Nothing there." No one with such a brazen willingness to overlook fact and evidence belongs in the Oval Office. What the columnist said. Donald Trump holds one core belief, said Franklin Foer in Slate.com. Misogyny. Throughout his decades in the public eye, he has made it clear that he views women as meat, prizes to be won in a male war of domination. He has boasted of his experiences with seemingly very happily married and important women, openly cheated on his first wife, and called his second wife a nice piece of blank. He disparages women who dare stand up to his bullying, including Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly, former rival Carly Fiorina, and numerous female journalists, with personal insults calling them fat, ugly, or disgusting. I used to reject the Democratic trope that the GOP was waging war on women, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Not anymore. If Republicans cannot bring themselves to condemn their frontrunners' disgusting verbal attacks on women, they are, by their silence, complicit. Republicans now find themselves engulfed in utter bone-chilling, sickness-inducing panic, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. If Trump is the GOP nominee, he will cost them scores of Senate and House seats and will hurt candidates for state legislatures, too. Trump is turning the gender gap favoring Democrats into an abyss deeper than the San Marianas Trench. He is currently viewed unfavorably by an astonishing 70% of women. The frontrunner thinks he can win in November by energizing a stampede of white male voters, but he'll send so many angry women and Hispanics to the polls that he couldn't possibly win. The GOP is a fractured party splitting even further apart, said Sahil Kapoor in Bloomberg.com. Now that the candidate's loyalty pledge is dead, it's doubtful that the GOP is capable of uniting its three camps. Trump's nativist and nationalist, Cruz's ideological conservatives, and Kasich's moderates. How can Trump or Cruz beat the Democratic nominee without the support of one or two of these segments? And a second main story this week, Brussels investigation hampered by mistakes. What happened? Belgian authorities faced mounting criticism at home and throughout Europe this week after admitting they had committed a series of security errors both before and after the suicide bombings in Brussels. Belgian police have arrested at least 18 suspects since last week's ISIS-directed attacks on the city's airport and subway, which killed 32 people, including at least four Americans. Only one person, Belgian freelance journalist Fakhal Shefu, was charged directly in connection with the terrorist assaults, but was then released hours later in a possible case of mistaken identity. Authorities originally suspected Shefu was the third Zaventem airport attacker spotted in surveillance footage. That suspect is believed to have fled the scene when his explosives failed to detonate. But DNA tests failed to place Shefu at the airport. As the investigation continued, a mob of 400 far-right demonstrators overran a memorial to the Brussels victims, chanting "België barst," break up Belgium, a Flemish nationalist slogan. Police in Italy, France, and Germany arrested several new suspects linked to the Brussels attack, as well as November's terrorist rampage in Paris, which left 130 people dead. Security officials said they were increasingly confident that the Brussels and Paris atrocities were carried out by a single terrorist cell. But French President François Hollande warned that even as the cell was in the process of being wiped out, other terrorist networks were plotting new outrages. What the editorial said, Belgian authorities have some explaining to do, said the Wall Street Journal. They could have arrested suspected airport bomber Ibrahim El-Baruhi last year when he was deported to Europe by Turkey, which told Belgian officials the Brussels-born extremist had been detained near the Syrian border on suspicion of belonging to the Islamic State. Then, just days before the Brussels attack, Belgian police captured Salah Abdeslam, the alleged logistical mastermind of the Paris attacks. But they questioned him for only an hour and failed to ask about any future ISIS plots. The European Union has all Belgium's security problems on a larger scale, said the Washington Post. The bloc's 28 member nations have failed to coordinate on even simple intelligence pooling and can't agree on basic questions like whether mass electronic surveillance is an appropriate counterterrorism measure. The West needs to work together to defeat the Islamic threat, said the Tampa Bay Times. Yet Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump would have us withdraw from security challenges under his America First foreign policy strategy. The billionaire has called for the U.S. to rein in its involvement in NATO and in the Middle East, Asia, and Europe, just when our allies most need America's robust presence and intelligence gathering abilities. What the columnist said. The Islamic State's lone wolf era is over, said Matthew Levitt in foreignpolicy.com. Forget small acts of violence by self-radicalized individual. After Paris and Brussels, it's clear ISIS is determined to direct attacks that are far more sophisticated and lethal. Security officials believe one terrorist network in Europe is at the heart of this violence, said Rukmini Kalimaki in the New York Times. That cell was once headed by Belgian national Abdelhamid Abaoud, whom experts believe spent 2 years arming and training an unknown number of European jihadists before blowing himself up in Paris. So is America next? Asked Daniel Benjamin in Politico.com. An attack on U.S. soil is much less likely, not least because America has been much more successful at assimilating Muslim immigrants than Europe. We've also spent $650 billion on improving homeland security since 9/11 and had the blessing of geography, two oceans that mean that outside extremists will need to fly to get here. For those reasons and others, Americans overestimate how much of a threat terrorism poses, says Jeremy Shapiro in Vox.com. Constant media coverage of Paris and Brussels has put vivid pictures in our heads of broken bodies and burnt-out airport terminals. But the reality is that we've had relatively few terrorist attacks in the U.S., while in 2015 there were 372 mass shootings that killed 475 people and wounded 1,870. Americans are also far more at risk of dying in a car crash than a terrorist attack. But terrorism is effective precisely because it creates levels of fear that overwhelm reason. We have met the enemy, and he is us. Our controversy of the week, Obama, still failing to take ISIS seriously? The split screen told the story, said Charles Krauthammer in the New York Daily News. As Belgian authorities were picking body parts off the floor of the Brussels airport last week, our TVs also showed us the President of the United States looking cool in a pair of $485 Oliver Peoples sunglasses, yucking it up with Cuban dictator Raul Castro at a baseball game in Havana, even joining the crowd and doing the wave. Obama didn't entirely ignore the bombings. He addressed them for all of 51 seconds before making a flowery, self-consciously historic speech to the Cuban people. Then Obama flew to Argentina, where he danced the tango at a state dinner. Obama simply refuses to act as if the war on ISIS is a big deal, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. After every fresh ISIS atrocity, including last year's massacres in Paris and San Bernardino, he makes a few dispassionate, boilerplate remarks and then returns to his scheduled activities. A round of golf, most notoriously, after ISIS beheaded James Foley in 2014. Our president seems to have no idea what is appropriate behavior at a time of tragedy and crisis. Obama's steady temperament is a blessing, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Let's not forget that his immediate predecessor, George W. Bush, was so rattled by the Islamic terrorism on 9/11 that he committed the single most catastrophic mistake in American foreign policy history, the 2003 invasion of Iraq that threw the region into chaos and gave rise to ISIS. Yet Republicans still seem to think all foreign policy is about threats and dangers and showing strength by threatening to go to war. While his critics were mocking Obama's eyewear and dance moves, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, U.S. military leaders quietly announced that they had killed two of ISIS's most senior leaders, using a raid strategy by special operations forces that Obama had pushed. However chilled out Obama may look, he always has his eye on the ball. No, he doesn't, said William Bradley in HuffingtonPost.com. Obama may be right to be wary of military adventurism, but he got ISIS wrong from the beginning, famously dismissing the terrorist group as Al-Qaeda's JV team. By responding with too little too late, the president let ISIS swell into an unprecedented terrorist army that conquered large regions in Iraq and Syria. And when ISIS began exporting its barbarity to Europe with the Paris attacks, Obama was content to stay with his policy of half-hearted, incremental warfare. If there are more terrorist spectaculars in coming months while Obama tangoes, he might see Americans turn in desperation to Donald Trump. Actually, Obama's strategy on ISIS seems to be working, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. ISIS-held territory has shrunk by 40% since 2014, thanks to sustained bombing and the underreported Special Operations Forces campaign. Frontline commanders are reporting that ISIS fighters have become ragged and demoralized and retreat whenever they meet strong resistance. By November, wouldn't it be awful for Republicans if the same weak-kneed appeaser who killed Osama bin Laden has had ISIS on the ropes? That may be a little optimistic, said Ted Picone in Time.com. ISIS will likely be with us long after Obama leaves office. But if we ever hope to see peace in the Middle East, we will need more of what Obama has made the priority of his presidency: diplomacy, outreach, and the promotion of American values. In the long run, winning hearts and minds will advance our country's interest far more effectively than tough talk and bluster. It was a good week for sniffing out a partner after a New York matchmaking service launched Smell Dating, which allows users to find potential mates by sniffing swatches of their unwashed T-shirts. You either really like the smell of someone or you don't, said founder Tega Bryan. It was a good week for a change of heart after Stephanie Segaleski, the former head of a Donald Trump super PAC, said the billionaire ran for president as a lark, never expected to get this far, and is not prepared or equipped to lead the nation. But his ego has now taken over, she said, and nothing else matters. And it was a good week for incredible excess after Russian oligarch Mikhail Gutsiriev threw a wedding for his son estimated to cost nearly $1 billion. It included a fleet of Rolls Royces to transport 600 guests, a 9-tiered wedding cake, and shows by Jennifer Lopez and Enrique Iglesias. But it was a bad week for law students after a California law school graduate lost her lawsuit against her former school, which she claimed had defrauded her out of $150,000 in tuition. Anna Alaburda, 37, has been unable to find a job as a lawyer for 10 years. It was a bad week for setting a good example after police were called to break up a fight at a California elementary school when parents began to brawl over seats at a kindergarten play. Sometimes adults act in a funny way, said Sheriff's Deputy Michael Vasquez. And it was a bad week for setting a good example, part two. After a crowd of greedy parents overwhelmed and trampled kids at a Connecticut Easter egg hunt, snatching up eggs and leaving toddlers bloody and in tears. It was worse than being at Walmart on Black Friday, one parent said. A brief programming note to our listeners. We're going to record two programs out of this issue of the Week magazine, and so we'll get a slightly different order of columns that we do. And with that said, I will start with a different page that we don't usually get to, the U.S. at a glance. Riverside, California. iPhone cracked. Federal officials this week dropped a bitter legal battle with Apple after an unnamed third party helped unlock the encrypted iPhone used by San Bernardino shooter Syed Rizwan Farouk, who with his wife killed 14 people in a December terrorist attack. We are now able to unlock that iPhone without compromising any information on the phone, U.S. Attorney Eileen Decker said in a statement after prosecutors asked Magistrate Judge Sherry Pym to vacate her order compelling Apple's assistance in cracking the device. Authorities remained mum about the details of the hack, the identity of the third party, and the contest of the phone, which are now being analyzed by the FBI. In a statement, Apple said the government's backdoor entry into the phone would set a dangerous precedent and leave unresolved a fierce national debate over security and privacy. Edmond, Oklahoma. Man-made quakes. Fracking for oil and gas has sparked a stunning surge of human-induced earthquakes, said the U.S. Geological Survey, revealed this week, threatening as many as 7 million people in states across the heart of the country, including Kansas, Texas, Arkansas, and Colorado. None has been hit harder than Oklahoma, which in just a few years has become one of the most seismically active places in the world. Between 1882 and 2012, the state saw 232 earthquakes of magnitude 3.0 or stronger, the threshold at which they're noticeable to people. In 2016 alone, Oklahomans have experienced 287 such quakes. In December, a series of powerful quakes knocked out power in Edmond, a suburb of Oklahoma City. We need to help people understand that they do face a risk in these areas, said USGS seismologist Mark Peterson, and they need to take precautions just like people in California do. Chippewa, New York, Clinton probe. Federal prosecutors investigating Hillary Clinton's use of a home email server while Secretary of State had begun setting up formal interviews with her closest aides, suggesting the probe has entered its final stages. Prosecutors are also expected to seek an interview with Clinton. The Washington Post initially reported this week that the FBI has assigned 147 agents to the investigation, citing an unnamed lawmaker briefed by FBI Director James Comey. The report was later corrected to reflect that fewer than 50 FBI personnel are involved. The State Department has so far released more than 30,000 of Clinton's emails, with nearly 2,100 retroactively given some form of classification. This is clearly disruptive to the campaign, said Democratic pollster Mark Melman. Important aides being questioned is not coverage you'd like to have. Indianapolis, abortion ban. Doctors in Indiana struggled this week to understand how sweeping new abortion restrictions might affect their work after Governor Mike Pence signed a controversial bill that bans women from terminating pregnancies because the fetus has Down syndrome or another disorder. The law, which takes effect July 1st, also bans abortions on the basis of the fetus' gender or race and makes Indiana the first state to mandate the burial or cremation of fetal remains. Opponents of the law complain that the restrictions will interfere with physicians' ability to offer medical care and advice because a doctor could now face a wrongful death lawsuit if an abortion is granted to a woman on the basis of a fetal defect. Utah, meanwhile, became the first state to require doctors to administer anesthesia to women undergoing abortions at 20 weeks or later, based on the disputed notion that the fetuses feel pain at that stage. And we'll read a few shorts from the page titled The World at a Glance. Havana. Castro versus Obama. Former Cuban leader Fidel Castro, who wasn't present at any events during President Obama's visit to Cuba last week, has published a screed accusing Obama of failing to understand Cuban history. Writing in the state paper Granma, Castro mocked Obama's call to set aside decades of animosity between U.S. and Cuba. Each of us runs the risk of a heart attack hearing these words from a U.S. president, said Castro, outlining a long list of grievances, including the U.S.-backed 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion that should never be forgotten. Analysts said the fact that Castro waited until after Obama's departure to launch his criticism shows that he does not intend to undermine his brother Raul Castro's new opening to the U.S. Mexico City. Flaming Trumps. Mexicans burned and exploded effigies of Donald Trump this year in their Easter weekend Burning of Judas ritual. Usually an effigy of an unpopular local politician takes the place of Jesus' portrayer. But at this year's festivities, Trump figures, some of them adorned with swastikas, were most popular. Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto recently criticized the GOP presidential frontrunner's bellicose rhetoric against Mexicans, saying, that's how Mussolini got in. That's how Hitler got in. Also spotted on the streets of Mexico City during celebrations were effigies of recently captured drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman and of Kate Del Castillo, the actress who helped arrange actor Sean Penn's Rolling Stone interview with the cartel boss. Buenos Aires. Falklands oil at stake. The Argentine government was celebrating this week after the United Nations declared that the potentially oil-rich waters around the British-ruled Falkland Islands belong to Argentina. A UN commission endorsed a new maritime boundary proposed by Buenos Aires in 2009, expanding the area of the South Atlantic Ocean under Argentina's sovereignty by 650,000 square miles, encompassing the archipelago. This is a historic occasion, said Argentina's foreign minister, Susana Malcorra. The British government dismissed the commission's finding, noting that the UN body is not allowed to consider cases, like the Falklands, in which overlapping territorial claims are made. Argentina tried and failed to seize the disputed islands in a brief 1982 war with the UK. Beijing. Who wrote that letter? Chinese authorities have detained and questioned more than a dozen people, including journalists, website technicians, and family members of overseas dissidents, in an effort to discover who wrote a letter calling for President Xi Jinping to resign. The mysterious missive, which first appeared on an overseas Chinese language human rights site and was then republished on the China-based Wuji News site, accuses Xi of centralizing power in himself, personally directing economic and foreign policy, and bypassing other Communist Party bigwigs. The writer claims to speak for loyal party members and says Xi has weakened the power of all state organs. Zhang Ping, a Chinese human rights activist living in Germany, said his two younger brothers had been arrested in southwestern China and that police have even ordered his distant relatives to tell him to stop criticizing the party. Pyongyang, North Korea. Famine coming. A month after the UN imposed sweeping new sanctions on North Korea over its recent nuclear tests, North Korean state media is warning that the country could fall into famine. Another arduous march, when we would be forced to eat grass, could come about, and we are left in isolation to fight against the enemy, declared state newspaper Rodong Sinmun. The 1995 through 98 famine killed millions when North Korea diverted food to the army and the people starved to death. The same day as the famine warning, state media showed photos of dictator Kim Jong-un and his wife touring a posh department store. On the briefing page, Belgium's jihadi problem. How did a tiny nation at the heart of the EU become a hub for Islamic terrorism? What's gone wrong in Belgium? The country has now been tied to all three of the most recent major terrorism attacks in Europe, on European soil. The Charlie Hebdo killers got their guns from Belgium. The ISIS-inspired Paris attackers, who slaughtered 130 people in November, plotted that massacre in Belgium. And now, Belgian-born terrorists have struck in their own country, killing 35 people and injuring more than 300 in the capital, Brussels, last week. A toxic combination of dysfunctional government, mass immigration, and lax security has allowed parts of this nation of just 11.2 million people to become hotbeds of Islamic extremism, particularly the Brussels neighborhood of Molenbeek. Security officials fear it's just a matter of time before Belgian terrorists launch their next assault, either in Belgium or only a short drive away in Paris, Frankfurt, or Amsterdam. The situation was left to rot too long, says counterterrorism expert Claude Moniquet, and we let radical Islamists take control. How large is Belgium's Muslim population? There are about 640,000 Muslims living in the country, many of them second and third generation descendants of Moroccan and Turkish immigrants brought over as cheap labor in the 1960s. Belgium has made little effort to assimilate these immigrants. The country's own national culture is fractured, with deep linguistic and ideological divisions between its Dutch-speaking Flemish and French-speaking Walloons. Immigrants were actually encouraged to form their own insulated urban enclaves. When factories began closing in the 1970s, unemployment, poverty, and alienation set in. Today, the grandchildren of Muslim immigrants still feel estranged from their own country, and a small but dangerous minority have turned to crime and Islamist extremism. You have so many people who are adrift and decide terrorism is a shortcut to paradise, said Spanish counterterrorism prosecutor Dolores Delgado. It gives them a chance to get revenge on society. Who recruits them? Radical street preachers with extremist groups such as Sharia for Belgium. These recruiters wander through the poor North African neighborhoods, telling disaffected young men they're being discriminated against because they're Muslims, and encouraging them to fight with the jihadist groups in the Middle East. Per capita, Belgium has provided the highest number of ISIS recruits in the Western world, with about 560 Belgians waging jihad in Iraq and Syria. At first, Belgian counterterrorism officials were actually happy to see these young extremists leave. But as the Western coalition battling ISIS has eroded the group's territory in Iraq and Syria, its young European fighters have pivoted toward their home countries as a new battleground. About 120 Belgian jihadists have returned, and their mission is terrorist attacks, intelligence officers say. How is Belgium responding? Its security forces have proved to be amazingly dysfunctional. When suspected terrorist attacker Salah Abdeslam, a Belgian national, slipped back over the border into Belgium after the siege, it took counterterrorism officials 4 months to locate the most wanted man in Europe, even though he was living in Molenbeek, yards from his childhood home. After his capture, Politico.com reported last week, intelligence officials questioned Abdeslam for only 1 hour over 4 days. Belgium's security forces are small in number and have been overwhelmed by the extremist threat. Frankly, we don't have the infrastructure to properly investigate hundreds of individuals suspected of terror links, one anonymous counterterrorism official told BuzzFeed.com. Belgium's government, meanwhile, is paralyzed by division and bureaucracy. Why is the government so divided? Belgium is essentially three distinct regions glued together. Dutch-speaking Flanders in the north, French-speaking Wallonia in the south, and Brussels, capital. Each of these regions has its own overlapping and labyrinthine government. The city of Brussels, for example, has 19 different municipalities and 6 different police departments. Officials engage in constant political infighting, making it difficult to organize a cohesive counterterrorism response. Molenbeek Mayor Francois Schepmans has admitted that months before the Paris attacks, she was given a list with the names and addresses of more than 80 suspected Islamic militants in her area, but failed to act. "What was I supposed to do about them?" Schepmans said. "It is not my job to track down possible terrorists." Can Belgium adapt? Money is now being poured into Belgium's overwhelmed security apparatus, and the intelligence services are trying to recruit more Arabic-speaking analysts for surveillance efforts. Security officials have also called for the EU to do a much better job of sharing information about potential terrorists. But the best way to tackle Belgium's homegrown problem is to prevent radicalization in the first place, says Yves Goldstein, cabinet chief to the Brussels regional president. That would require integrating ghettos like Molenbeek into Belgian society, diversifying the schools, and bringing in new cafes, businesses, and cultural offerings. "We need to open the minds of these young people," said Goldstein. "What can we do to manage young people who prefer death to life?" Molenbeek, Europe's jihadi capital. Filled with the kebab shops and tea houses, the largely Moroccan Brussels neighborhood of Molenbeek has become the heart of a terrorist network that has caused carnage across Europe. The district, with a population of 100,000, was home to several of the Paris attackers, as well as other terrorist suspects. High school dropout and youth unemployment rates in Molenbeek are among the highest in all of Belgium, and radical preachers hang out at cafes and mosques in the area, trying to persuade these disaffected young men and women to embrace Islamist extremism as a source of meaning and glory. Many of the young recruits are already involved in crime, and when Belgian Muslims do turn to extremism, they are often protected from the authorities by their neighbors. When you do a raid on a house, in normal areas, people talk or help if they think someone was a terrorist, said Belgian federal prosecutor Eric van der Sipt. People are not collaborating in Molenbeek. They are throwing stones at the police. We'll take in a few columns now. The first two from the U.S. Arizona's voting fiasco. When citizens of Maricopa County, Arizona, had to wait for hours to vote in the state's presidential primary last week, it was a preview of a possible catastrophe for our democracy, said E.J. Dionne. Maricopa includes Phoenix, the state's largest city, which has a non-white majority and is a Democratic island in a Republican county. In what was billed as a cost-cutting move, Maricopa officials reduced the number of polling places by 70%, from 200 to 60. That left one station per 21,000 voters, compared with one per 2,500 voters in the rest of the state. The predictable result? When voters went to the polls, they were met with endless lines, some as long as 5 hours. Under the Voting Rights Act, Maricopa's drastic cuts would have required Justice Department approval. But the Supreme Court's conservative majority gutted the act in 2013, insisting voters no longer needed protection from discrimination. Now that Republicans in 16 states have enacted severe voting restrictions, imagine what is likely to happen when Americans elect a president on November 8th. If millions of black Hispanics and the working poor are blocked from voting, it'll be an electoral cataclysm and the result will be tainted. Remember who made Trump famous? Who's to blame for Donald Trump? Asked Jim Lewis. Liberals are blaming Fox News and other right-wing news outlets for inflaming the white working class with class envy and racial resentment, and the Republican Party for not standing up to a loathsome bully. But the culture that initially made Trump a celebrity wasn't the one that goes hunting on weekends, nor was it a Ku Klux Klan newsletter that first brought Trump to our attention. It was Time and Esquire and Spy. Who gave him his own TV show? NBC. Our coastal cultural gatekeepers have been totally complicit in this crass hustler's 30-year campaign of self-promotion, chuckling ironically at the materialism and sexism, and profiting from his ability to sell newspapers and books and boost TV ratings. Even when Trump became rancidly political and railed that President Obama was a Muslim born in Kenya, the Washington Post invited him to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. What good fun. Would, say, David Duke have gotten the same invitation? No. But Trump wasn't a redneck, so the elites indulged him. But now that the game has gotten out of hand, let's remember who helped create this monster. A couple of columns from Europe, the first from the United Kingdom. Overworked doctors are a danger to all. We British doctors are about to stage an unprecedented strike, and the public is on our side, said Ben Kirk. Later this month, junior doctors, known in the U.S. as medical residents, will walk off the job en masse, including from emergency room duty. Some 5,000 non-emergency surgeries have already been canceled. No patients will be harmed because we've given enough notice that senior doctors and other practitioners will be able to cover ERs. In fact, we are doing this because we care about our patients. The conservative government is hell-bent on delivering on its manifesto pledge that the National Health Service will provide routine services 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Yet it refuses to hire more doctors or raise their pay. Instead, it is simply increasing junior doctors' work hours. Already, most of us are toiling within a whisker of mental and physical burnout. A confidential clinic set up to treat doctors says many younger doctors are suffering PTSD-like symptoms because their hours are so intense. Such overwork very much risks patient safety. We all know that the link between fatigue and adverse events is as well documented in medicine as it is in aviation. Give us junior doctors a rest, or patients will suffer. And this from Bosnia-Herzegovina. Let down as a butcher is sentenced. The butcher of Bosnia has been sentenced to 40 years in prison. But Bosnians expected more, said Denevi List. Radovan Karadzic headed the breakaway Bosnian Serb Republic during the nation's brutal 1992 to 1995 war. and led a devastating military campaign to wipe out all Bosnian Muslims and ethnic Croats from what he considered Serb territory. The United Nations rightfully calls him the architect of destruction and murder on a massive scale. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia convicted Karadzic last week of genocide for ordering the July 1995 massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys in the city of Srebrenica, and of crimes against humanity for other atrocities. It's a historic judgment and a fitting one, yet some Bosnians are asking why Karadzic did not get a genocide conviction for the lesser-known slaughters in Prijedor, Zvornik, and Vlasinska, where thousands were murdered and tens of thousands were driven from their homes. They also wonder why Karadzic didn't get a life sentence for his heinous crimes. Now 70, he will surely die in prison before his 40 years are up, but a life sentence would have sent a powerful message to other genocidal leaders around the world. We expect more convictions and a longer sentence on appeal. Otherwise, Bosnians will be disappointed. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The catcher who became a Rye broadcaster, Joe Garagiola, 1926 to 2016. By his own admission, Joe Garagiola was a mediocre major league catcher. But the bald, beaming everyman made baseball's Hall of Fame as a sportscaster, whose sharp insights and self-deprecating wit charmed generations. His six-decade broadcasting career was launched in an unlikely setting, a 1954 U.S. Senate subcommittee on monopolies in sports, back when he was playing for the Chicago Cubs. Garagiola's irreverent testimony won him raves and a broadcasting gig with the St. Louis Cardinals. He was inexperienced, but undaunted. "I used to sit in the bullpen and say, 'Why the hell doesn't he throw the curveball?'" Garagiola recalled. "Well, all I had to do to become an announcer was take out the hell." Garagiola was raised in a working-class St. Louis neighborhood where his best friend was future Hall of Famer Yogi Berra, said the New York Times. "Not only was I not the best catcher in the major leagues," he quipped, "I wasn't even the best catcher on my street." Still, Garagiola landed a Cardinals contract at 16 and made his big league debut in 1946. Never more than a part-time player, he retired in 1954 and took to the booth. He began broadcasting games for NBC in 1961 and was a regular on the network's Game of the Week telecast from 1976 to 1988. Without losing his affable middle American presence, he branched out to co-host the Today Show and occasionally sat in for Johnny Carson on the Tonight Show, said the Washington Post. Garagiola stopped covering games in 2013. To the end, he kept it unpretentious. "I want the broadcast to sound like two guys sitting at the ballpark talking," he explained. "It's not a seminar, it's a ball game." And we'll read a few items from the business pages this week. This is on the Making Money page called What the Experts Say. Fear not, tax procrastinators. If you've waited to file your taxes, you're not alone, said Jeff Reeves in USA Today. About 20% of taxpayers wait until the last week before the deadline to file their returns. But procrastinators need not worry. All taxpayers can get an extra 6 months to file by asking for an extension using Form 4868. You can even file for an extension online using the IRS's free file software. Just keep in mind that an extension to file your taxes doesn't absolve you from sending in owed taxes by April 18th. The extension only applies to your paperwork, not your payment. Taxpayers must estimate their final bill and send money or face a failure to pay penalty. That's generally 0.5% of the total tax bill for each month that goes unpaid. Passing on a home. It's not that easy anymore to give your home to a son or daughter tax-free, said Bill Bischoff in MarketWatch.com. But it's possible, and you've got to plan ahead. If you plan to live in the home until you die and the value of your estate is below the $5.45 million estate tax exemption, your best strategy is simply to stay put. Your home's tax basis is stepped up to fair market value as of your date of death, allowing your heirs to escape capital gains tax on its appreciation. If you want to give it as an outright gift before that, things get more complicated. You can offset the amount of the gift by using your $14,000 annual gift tax exclusion. If you and your spouse each make a gift to both your child and his or her spouse, you can offset $56,000 of the home's value. On the business page, the news at a glance. Labor. California plans a $15 minimum wage. The nation's most populous state is poised to lead the way toward higher pay for the working poor, said Sharon Bernstein in Reuters.com. California Governor Jerry Brown struck a deal this week with legislative and labor leaders to raise the statewide minimum wage from $10 to $15 per hour by 2022, giving Californians the highest base wages in the nation. 14 states and several major cities began 2016 with minimum wage increases. But this is the biggest victory yet for the Fight for $15 movement, which has galvanized labor organizers and liberal politicians nationwide. How California's diverse economy handles the new wage floor will be of interest to policymakers around the country, said Alejandro Lazo and Eric Morath in the Wall Street Journal. The new minimum pay applies to all industries and areas, ranging from the technology-rich San Francisco Bay Area to the mix of manufacturing, entertainment, and low-wage work of Southern California, and the vast agricultural industry of Central Valley. Roughly 5 million Californians, 38% of the state's workforce, will see an average annual pay increases of about $4,000 each. But some economists worry job losses may be in store. Music. Pandora looks to past for revivals. Pandora is replacing its CEO with one of its co-founders, and the company looks to regain its footing in an increasingly crowded online music streaming market, said Ben Cesario in the New York Times. Tim Westergren, who served as chief strategy officer during the company's early years of rapid growth, will return as CEO, replacing Brian McAndrews, who has held the job for less than 3 years. Shares in Pandora have plummeted 75% from their peak in 2014, as the company's number of monthly users has stagnated, falling slightly from 81.5 million at the end of 2014 to 81.1 million last year. Airlines. Virgin America fields takeover bids. More consolidation is afoot in the airline industry, said David Shep in CBSNews.com. Virgin America, the nation's ninth largest airline, is in talks to sell itself either JetBlue Airways or Alaska Airlines, according to multiple reports. The airline, founded by British billionaire Richard Branson in 2007, has only begun making money in the last 2 years. Even so, Virgin's revenue has been squeezed by its bigger rivals, which have added seats to gain market share and take advantage of record low fuel costs. Tech. Yahoo board steps up sale plans. With a bruising boardroom battle on its hand, Yahoo is finally getting serious about a sale, said Miriam Gottfried in the Wall Street Journal. The struggling internet pioneer has given potential buyers until April 11th to submit preliminary bids for its core web business. Plus its stake in Yahoo Japan and Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba. The effort comes less than a week after activist hedge fund Starboard Value announced it would try to replace Yahoo's entire board with its own slate of directors. Starboard has accused Yahoo's board of dragging its feet on exploring a sale. Netflix catalog is shrinking as the company focuses on its own original programming. The streaming giant offered 6,494 movies and 1,609 TV shows for viewing in January 2014. As of March 2016, it was 4,335 movies and 1,197 shows. Netflix plans to release 31 original shows in 2016, double its output in 2015. Annual sales of men's undergarments across North America are now $1.1 billion higher compared with 2009, giving credence to the so-called Men's Underwear Index. The index, whose champions include former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, posits that sales of necessities like underwear are normally stable but rise in times of economic recovery and growth. The number of starter homes on the market in the 100 largest U.S. cities has dropped by about 44% since 2012, according to real estate listing site Trulia. The lack of supply has driven up prices for modest entry-level houses by 104% in Oakland, 78% in Denver, and 50% in Portland. And we'll finish with a quote. This one from Sally Field. We stay who we are no matter how old we get. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.